In this presentation, I'd like to at least introduce the complexities of defining addiction. What is an addiction? And that'll have some significant implications for also thinking about what is recovery, which I'll develop more later on in the class, but I'll talk about that a bit this morning. So first, let me just list a series of realities that any attempt to define addiction would need to pay attention to. The first and the pretty obvious one is that most people who consume addictive substances are not addicted to them. So a definition would have to distinguish use from misuse and misuse from addiction somehow. And I think this is sort of obvious, although it's quite remarkable how often people neglect to pay attention to this. But most people who drink alcohol are not alcoholics. Most people who have sex are not sex addicts. Even most people who smoke opium are not opium addicts. Most people who are exposed to fentanyl are not fentanyl addicts. I've had five surgeries in the last 2 years, each time exposed to a good deal of fentanyl, and there's no signs that I'm addicted to fentanyl. Exposure is different from addiction. Second thing to note is, and why definitional issues are particularly important, is that there really is no test for addiction. You can't take a blood sample and have it come back, you know, yes or no, is this person addicted? You can't do a brain scan and have that tell you whether it's... So you're just going to be looking at symptoms of different kinds. And that leaves a lot of room for subjective interpretations and complexities. Thirdly, the sort of symptoms of addiction vary pretty dramatically depending on the substance we're talking about. There are addictive substances that cause intoxication, for example. And there's others that don't seem to cause that much intoxication, at least. There's a very big difference between the intoxication caused by a consumption of alcohol and intoxication caused by exposure to nicotine. Now, both are addictive, but you can't just look at the levels of intoxication or the kind of intoxication to define addiction. It's got to cover both of those somehow. It's also true that some addictive substances lead to tolerance. That is, you find that you have to use more and more to achieve the same mood-altering effect. But others don't seem to involve tolerance. That is, whatever dose works for you, you just stick to that dose. I think most commonly LSD addiction is like that. You don't need more and more to have the same level of mood alteration. Once you find the level that kind of works for you, you stick with that. And tolerance is not a particular problem. Your body doesn't learn how to metabolize LSD the way it learns how to metabolize alcohol. Another thing related to tolerance is that some addictive substances create a tolerance that is persistent. That is, if you are addicted to alcohol, for example, over time your body will learn how to metabolize alcohol better and you will need more and more alcohol to get the same effect. If you suddenly stop taking alcohol for a period of time, but then take it up again, you can probably go back to the level of alcohol consumption that you were doing before you took that break. Your body is still able to metabolize that higher level of alcohol consumption. But that's dramatically not the case for things like cocaine or opiates. If you use opiates for a while and then you take a break and then you relapse, you go back to it and you think, well, I can take the same level of opiates that I used to take when I used to use, the risk of overdose is very, very high because your body forgets how to metabolize those substances. So again, it's a difference between different kinds of substances that makes using tolerance as a way to assess addiction very shaky. It sort of works any way you would talk about that would apply differently to different substances. It's also true that cold turkey withdrawal from consumption of some substances is relatively mild, but in cold turkey withdrawal from other substances can be life-threatening. The need for medically supervised detox is particularly important in the case of alcohol and benzodiazepines. These are substances which, during withdrawal, produce very significant cardiac risk, and it's just really prudent to have those withdrawal from alcohol and tranquilizers be done under medical supervision. Other issues. Some addictive substances have a really dramatic effect on normal functioning. Your life starts to fall apart really quickly. Others don't have that impact. You can be a high-functioning alcoholic and sort of function in certain ways. But, over time, that functioning tends to fade and fade away. But in the case of nicotine, for example, you can maintain a high level of functioning in daily skills of living and daily activities for quite a long time with nicotine because the intoxication is mild and the level of disorder in one's life tends to be much lower until the long-term impact of nicotine kicks in. But that long-term impact, maybe 25 or 30 years later, when the cumulative harm that nicotine and tobacco consumption causes eventually accumulates to be life-threatening. Because there isn't tests for addiction, it can't be identified by any known test, a lot of the behavioral indicators that you can look for wind up being things that are very difficult to quantify. You might want to have as part of a definition the notion that there's some kind of craving involved. But how do you quantify craving? What's the difference between something you really, really want and something you crave? You can try to define that some way, but when it gets right down to it, it's going to be hard to distinguish between different levels of harm, different levels of withdrawal, different levels of craving, things like that, that are some of the things that wind up in definitions of addiction. The intensity of those factors ranges a lot, but they're very difficult to quantify, making the whole definitional process more complicated. I think it's also true that this is most important in therapeutic culture, I suppose, but it's very difficult to distinguish between addiction and obsessive compulsive behavior. These are in two separate categories in the DSM-5. So in therapeutic culture, they're construed to be completely different kind of realities. But in the real world, there might be a lot of overlap between these things, and definitions aren't maybe going to help very much to distinguish those two. Another thing that varies a great deal is if you ask people who seem to you to be addicted why they use their substance of choice, people give radically different answers. Some people say that they use to feel good. It makes me feel better. Other people say, I use because I don't want to feel bad. I use to not feel. So people use stuff to feel, and then people use stuff to not feel, both. And then there's a large number of people who will say, I had a friend who used to say fairly frequently that if it was Tuesday, he drank because it was Tuesday. If it was Wednesday, he drank because it was Wednesday. He didn't need any additional reasons for drinking. He would drink when he was happy. To seldom celebrate, he'd drink when he was sad to feel better. He'd drink, just no additional motivation was needed. Once you are addicted, you don't have to have other reasons. Next, it's certainly true that a large number of addicted people have adverse childhood experiences or traumas or abuse of some kind in their backgrounds. And different people put in different kind of weights on this factor as causative factors. It's certainly not a universal truth that trauma leads to addiction. It can lead to all kinds of stuff other than addiction. Some addicts have trauma in their background and some don't. So it's not really that predictive. It's also a complexity to defining addiction that comes from the fact that there's different stages in the addictive process. Early in addiction, an alcoholic, for example, might say, alcohol is my best friend. It's the only thing I can rely on. And it's sort of a positive sensibility about their attachment to alcohol. Later on, when the damage mounts up, you might hear the same person saying, I hate this stuff. I passionately hate alcohol, but I can't stop. And that is that difference in subjective experience of different kinds of addictive substances makes addictions hard to define. There's two companion sort of risks when it comes to the broadness of defining addiction. If you have a very inclusive definition for addiction, you can wind up feeling that everybody's got attachments to something, and so everybody's addicted. There's a risk there that in having too broad a definition, you'll see a bunch of false positives. An example comes to mind. I had a mom of an adolescent boy call me once, and she had found that her, I think he was 15-year-old, her 15-year-old son had been masturbating, and she was beside herself in concern and anxiety, and really wanted me to tell her which of the local Sexaholics Anonymous groups it would be best to refer her son to. Now, this is a person who carries an enormously expansive definition of sexual addiction. My instinct was there's clearly a problem here. It has to do with a mom with out of control anxiety who needs some help about that, needs to be better educated about sexuality. And because it's not enough Just because someone is masturbating does not mean that they're a sex addict. Just because someone's engaged in sexual behaviors that I disapprove of doesn't mean they're a sexual addict. They may be doing stuff that I disapprove of, but that's not the same as being a sexual addict. A sexual addict needs to be a more specific diagnosis than that if it's to be useful at all. Now, the companion risk is if you have a definition that's too narrow, you may have a bunch of false negatives. You may miss a lot of addiction that's there because it doesn't meet the kind of specific requirements for being an addiction. So you're kind of between a rock and a hard place about how broad a definition you have. And I don't know that there's any right or wrong answers about that. It's just another level of complexity that is part of thinking about addiction. It's also, this was not apparent to me for a very long time, but it's now very clear to me that the kinds of definitions of addiction that are useful in discussions about public policy are really different from the kinds of definitions that are useful in a clinical context. And those in turn are also very different from the kind of definitions of addiction that might be useful in pastoral contexts. So there isn't kind of a one-size-fits-all definition. It's just too complex a reality for that. Just a few other things. I think there's a wide difference between the rapidity at which the onset of symptoms shows up. Sometimes, well, I have a member of my extended family who drank to the point of blackout the very first time she was exposed to alcohol. Her first drink, she kept drinking until she blacked out. And that was her drinking culture for her entire career as an alcoholic. So that's kind of at one extreme is really significant consequences from first exposure. There's also many other people who may have to work really hard at becoming an alcoholic. They may be social drinkers for 20 years and problem drinkers for another 20 years, and then eventually they cross some kind of line that where a loss of control kicks in, and all of a sudden they're an alcoholic, and they had to spend a long time getting there. And defining addiction would need to somehow account for that reality. A final consideration worth noting that makes defining addiction very complicated is the fact that the person in a family system who's the identified addict is not the only person in the family system who is impacted by addiction. It's not just that they're impacted by another person's addiction, is that they take on many of the characteristics of the addictive process without having, without engaging in the behavior that seems to be the problem in the person you love. So codependents, parents, spouses, children often wind up obsessively concerned, addictively concerned with the person they love. If the person they love is doing well, seems to be getting back on their feet, they feel good. If they're not doing well, they feel bad. Their mood is determined by someone else's behavior. This is a very unusual kind of disease when it can be transmitted within a family system, can be transmitted intergenerationally, But that is one of the complications about addiction that's a really important characteristic of the addictive process, and we'll talk more about that a little later in the class. Bottom line for me is a question that keeps coming back, and that is addiction one thing or is it many different things? That obviously will have an impact on what and what kind of definition you might want to land on. To me, there's kind of a useful analogy to cancer. 20, 25 years ago, when people talked about cancer, they would feel quite comfortable talking about finding a cure for cancer. It was as if cancer was one thing, and we were going to do whatever we had to do to find a cure for that one thing. 25 years later, pretty much everybody understands that cancer is not one thing. Breast cancer is not the same thing as prostate cancer. It's not the same thing as colon cancer or lung cancer. And the kind of cures that people have come up with tend to be very, very specific to a particular kind of cancer. It's not just this is a cure for colon cancer. It's this is a cure for colon cancers that have particular genetic markers that are in a certain stage of development and may, you know, have other kinds of criteria you have to meet in order to for professionals to think that this treatment would be helpful to you. It seems likely to me that addiction is kind of like that, that addiction isn't one thing, that it's a whole bunch of different things that we don't yet really have the right kind of language for. We're still learning about that diversity, and that the solutions may be pretty diverse. Time will tell whether I'm right about that or not, but that's my instinct. So let's look a bit at the different kinds of theories of addiction that inform the creation of definitions for addiction. This is my best attempt at kind of giving a sense of the range of possibilities here. This is obviously built on the old fable about a bunch of blind people telling you what an elephant looks like, but they're each holding a different part of the elephant and coming up with very different versions. So here the elephant in the room is addiction, and these are all people trying to come up with ways of explaining what's going on. Let's start with a guy holding the tail. He thinks it's basically addiction is about moral failure. This was the dominant way of thinking about addictions for centuries. It was the core instinct about addictions that fueled the temperance movement, which lasted the bulk of the 19th century and well into the early 20th century. It was people who were sinning, making sinful choices, doing bad things, failing morally. And that was the problem. That was the nature of the problem. Now, for each of these perspectives on addiction, I'm going to try to convince you that there are both positives and negatives about each perspective. In this case, the negatives are kind of on the surface of things. It can make talking about addiction just being a sort of shame delivery device, shaming you for being bad. But I think it'd be close to the truth to say that kind of the notion of sin in this context ought not to just be about helping people feel bad. That historically, at least in the Christian tradition, talking about sin was connected with processes, penitential spiritual practices, that help people recover from the damage of sin. And there was some hope in that, and some it's not just you're a horrible person. It's there are pathways towards being the person that you'd rather be. Now, that's a pretty hard sell in at the present time in American culture. Stuff about moral failure just feels very judgmental. It need not be so, but I think that sort of rejection of moral thinking is a hostile reaction that is well deserved given the behavior of the Christian community over the last century or so. People can't see anything more than judgmentalism. They don't see it as being about hope and pathways to healing and stuff like that. The guy in the back of the elephant is the sociologist in the group. He looks at addiction and says, this is really about social realities. It's not about sort of moral decisions that an individual makes. It's about the facts of social situations, and social dislocations and disruptions are what really lead to addictions and cause addictions, and we should define addiction largely in sociological terms. The modern sensibilities about this came out of a series of experiments done by an addictionologist named Bruce Alexander in Vancouver, and he did a series of experiments famously called the Rat Park experiments. And he observed that if you take rats and you put them in those small rat cages and give them two bottles of water, one just full of just water and one bottle full of water plus cocaine, the rats will drink the water and cocaine bottle dry. A lot of them will overdose drink until they die. If, however, you put the rats in a very large rat cage with lots of rat amenities to it, you know, places to go, different ecosystems in this large rat cave with multiple other rats to socialize with in various ways, and still give them two sources of water, they will preferentially choose the water without the cocaine. Suggesting that, at least in rats, the problem that leads to obsessional use of drugs might be not in the brain or in the moral reasoning of individual rats, but in the social conditions under which they exist. Now, I don't have time to sort of pick up part Dr. Alexander's work here. It is, after all, work in rats, and translating that into work with humans is not always straightforward and forward. As a theory of addiction, though, it does have the advantage that you can test this in part. You can look at different kinds of large-scale social dislocations and ask, is an increase in addiction associated with social dislocation, social trauma? So, and there's some obvious examples of that. The collapse of the Soviet Union leading to increased vodka assumption in Russia. There's kind of a raft of papers right now about the impact of the COVID pandemic on opium overdoses. It's a little complicated in that it's clear that the rate of overdoses has gone up, but it's not entirely clear just yet whether that's because of increased usage or whether it's a result of the fact that we're living in much more isolated conditions, and so people who overdose aren't found as quickly as they would be in other situations. And so people who might have been given naltrexone or, you know, revived or taken to an emergency room for help, that's not happening as much. I think it'll be go wow before we're able to look back on this pandemic and ask whether or not the real rate of use of addictive substances went up or down. There is some interesting preliminary evidence about the consumption of alcohol during the COVID epidemic, but it's not yet. Clear patterns have been emerged. There are states where the consumption of alcohol based on sales tax revenue has gone down about 20% since previous years, compared to previous years. But there's also states where consumption of alcohol, sales of alcohol, appear to have gone up by about 20%. So it's going to take more time before we really have good evidence about that. But one of the advantages of this theory is it is subject to assessment. We should be able to predict changes in consumption of addictive substances based on social dislocation. So it has something to offer there. It has some limits in that it doesn't really tell an individual what's going to help them or what to do now that they're addicted. But it does lead to some of these possible changes in public policy that might be helpful to large groups of alcoholics. The whole housing first movement, I think, emerged out of this kind of theory about addictions, that if you're homeless, you're not going to be able to sustain sobriety, so you need a house first, or a place to live, a safe place to live first, before you can work effectively on sobriety. The guy sitting on the elephant's head is a neuroscientist. He's convinced that the problem is located not in the moral decision-making processes of an individual, not in the social conditions in which the person lives, but it is located in the brain. The problem is in the brain. And I'm sure you've all been exposed to this way of thinking. It turns out to be, I think, a very important and useful way of thinking about addictions. It is particularly important when discussions about addiction are really about public policy. That is, unless addiction is a medical disease, it's going to be hard to convince insurance companies that they should cover this. So this is a much more salient way of thinking about addictions in a public policy context. It's really important for the health and safety of a whole lot of people that insurance companies have to cover treatment for the medical condition of addiction. So the kinds of addictions that come out of that way of thinking, while they might seem very reductionist, they certainly do to me, but they play a really important role in our overall response to addictions. We have a geneticist in the crowd who's holding the trunk. He's convinced that the problem is not in the moral decision-making process, not in the social conditions, not in the brain. The problem is in the genes. And so he's doing twin studies and things like that to look at how genetically transmitted information impacts the incidence of alcoholism or other kinds of addictive problems. And, I'm personally convinced that there's pretty substantial evidence to suggest that in the case of alcoholism, at least, there is a significant genetic risk factor for alcoholism. It's not a simple, it's not like cystic fibrosis, which is classic Mendelian transmission of genes from parents to children, but there is an increased risk if you have a parent who's an alcoholic. There is an increased risk of alcoholism that their children carry. The weaknesses, again, with this is like any kind of medicalized model. There's a kind of reductionist instinct here. Just it's getting at one small factor. It doesn't see envision the larger picture. There is a chemist here holding the tusk. What I put down is the demon is in the rum. But a chemist is using a demon metaphorically. He thinks the problem is in the substance. The problem is not in moral decision making on part of the addicted person. It's not in the social system that is conducive to the development of addictions. It's not in the brain. It's not in the DNA. It's really in the chemicals. And so when you study addiction, you need to define addiction in terms of the interaction, the chemical structures, and the way those structures interact with different kinds of chemical receptors, neurotransmitter receptors in the brain or elsewhere. That's where you look to understand what addiction really is. And that's really important work, I think. It still has its brain and neuroscience, a kind of still a pretty primitive science, a scientific discipline early in its development. As in the case of neurochemistry studies or neurophysiological studies, it's an enormous advancement over previous eras when, you know, the science was even more primitive. But it has a long way to go to be providing us the kind of information I think we'd really like to have. And then we have a therapist here holding the front leg of the elephant. And here the instinct is that addiction is a symptom of an underlying problem. And so maybe it's self-medication of this other problem, but it's somehow addictions are symptoms rather than primary causes. So what you need to do is kind of treat the underlying causes and the addiction will kind of take care of itself. That's not an uncommon notion in therapeutic culture. And there's probably lots of people who are addicted for whom this is true. That trauma-informed therapy can be really helpful to people. But there's also, I think, lots and lots of people who are addicted for whom really the addiction needs to be the primary diagnosis. There may be all kinds of other things. Everybody's got stuff, so there's going to be other kinds of stuff that they need to work on. But if they can't sustain some sobriety, they're not going to be able to work on anything. So just for practical reasons, sobriety would probably be the best sort of first thing to work on rather than on underlying causes. Finally, there's a guy at the very back sitting on the ground, sitting at the location where they're most likely to get dumped on by the elephant, who's just totally confused. He's completely baffled. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about it, alcoholism as cunning, baffling, and powerful. But it's just really confusing. Now, it's true that the big book floats some what I'd call basically metaphors of addiction rather than definitions of addiction, but it several places talks about addiction, alcoholism specifically, as an allergy. But you have to remember this is written 38, 39, and Bill Wilson didn't. He's not a scientist. He's not a medical doctor. He doesn't know very much about allergies. Nobody knew that much about allergies back then. I mean, there were certainly research scientists who were getting some of the early insights into what an allergy was. But when Bill uses that term, he's basically just saying, you know, alcoholics are different from normies. We respond to alcohol differently than other people respond to alcohol. And that's not really a definition. It's just saying that there's a problem here and we're kind of baffled by it. Now, one of the remarkable things for me about looking at this range of instincts about how to, where to look for the problem and how to define it, is if you ask which of these people are, which of these perspectives or theories have contributed the most to helping people stay sober. It's very clearly the case that the person who's just baffled by it, has no idea how to explain this, has done the most to help people stay sober. That's the kind of instinct in you find in AA. They're not offering their own distinctive definition of addiction. They're saying we're as confused about this ourselves as other people are about us. And the one advantage of that sort of perspective is that it frees you up to not focus on defining addiction so much as asking, well, what helps people not be addicted? And that kind of focus on recovery, which is very distinctive here, has been very, very fruitful. You know, millions of people are sober today because people who are baffled about their condition decide to help each other. Now, there are elements of 12-step cult in elements in 12-step culture that are closely connected to many of these other things. The social dislocation theory of addiction is connected, I think, with the emphasis in 12-step culture on going to meetings. This is something we do together. The what's the old slogan? The most important word in the 12 steps is the first word, we. See, so it's sort of a re-socialization kind of process that happens in AA. That's one way of thinking about what goes on in AA. And there's also lots of connections with people who believe that it's about moral failure. When we talk about the spiritual dynamics of 12-step recovery, you'll see that it resembles, more than anything else, it resembles a kind of a classic penitential spiritual practices. People who know that they have failed morally and want to engage in the kinds of spiritual practices that help someone who has failed morally to change. And so there's a connection there. There's a connection with more therapeutically oriented instincts about addiction, and even with the more medical ones. One of the things I hope to get out of reading the big book is this kind of openness to the possibility that doctors and psychiatrists may come up with new information that would be really helpful to us. So it's not... at least back then in 1938, there wasn't a kind of hostility towards therapeutic culture and medical culture that you sometimes find in AA today. All right, I did just want to say, I don't have time today to talk about differing understandings of what recovery is. I just wanted to point out a... kind of one way of thinking about diversity and recovery that I found personally very helpful. And that is to distinguish between present tense oriented recovery, past tense oriented recovery, and future tense oriented recovery. Let me explain what I mean by that. AA is predominantly, particularly early in the recovery process, it is relentlessly focused on the present tense, one day at a time. If you take someone early in recovery, and you take them back into their past, the dominant feeling they're going to have is guilt, and they only have one way of dealing with guilt at the present time, and that's to drink. So you increase the likelihood of relapse by taking them into the past. If you take them into the future, the dominant feeling they're going to experience is fear. They only really have one way to manage fear, and that's to drink. So you really need to focus on stuff right now. Focus on the present tense. How am I going to stay sober today? Now, if you've never been addicted yourself, that may feel like such a small focus and kind of a narrow focus. There's no big picture there, you know? And it's hard to remember, I think, that staying sober for a day is, it's like the creator of the universe breaking into history and intervening on your behalf, doing the impossible, doing something that you wanted to do for a decade and just couldn't do, but you're able to stay sober for a day. It's like a big thing. It's not a little thing. One day of sobriety doesn't feel like a little thing in the subjective experience of an addicted person. It feels like a big thing. You can make a life out of one day at a time. Now, there is a little bit later, even in 12-step oriented recovery processes, a focus on the past. AA is quite disciplined about this in the fourth step, where you do a series of moral inventories of your past experiences. You go through your entire life, not just the period of time when you were addicted, but you go back and review your entire life looking at resentments. You know, what resentments did I accumulate in life? And make a very detailed list of those resentments and process them in a certain way. You usually, certainly if you do 12 steps the way it's recommended in the big book of AA, you do three separate moral inventories, sort of life reviews, one on resentments, one on fears, and one on sex, or more generally these days, kind of a relationship inventory. And so there's a lot of kind of reflecting on past experiences as part of the recovery process. Then there's also, even later in the recovery process, a focus on the future. How are you going to sustain the gains that you've made so far? How are you going to keep this up? There's also anything that's in the category of relapse prevention strategies is a kind of future-oriented recovery process. So, and anticipating times in the future where you might be at risk of relapse and planning ahead for what you can do then. You know, you need to go to the annual Christmas party at your parents' house, and Aunt Betty's going to give everybody a bottle of Jack Daniels like she's done every year for the last 20 years. So here you are with a bottle of Jack Daniels on Christmas, and everybody's excited about it. What are you going to do? Well, you need a plan. You need, and that kind of focus on the future is a useful part of recovery process. Again, it's a lot of the art to recovery is knowing when to focus on the present, when to focus on the past, when to focus on the future. All of us want eventually to be standing in the present, having dealt with the past, and facing our futures. But there's going to be a time and a place for each of those emphases, and I think it differs a lot for different people. Now, I realize that there is are some things about this particular presentation that might be frustrating. We're certainly not ending with Dale Ryan's recommended definition for addiction and definition for recovery. I mostly emphasized the complexity. There's two things I think important to remember about complexity. First, it's important to remember that while complexity can lead to confusion, it can also be the source of both intellectual humility and curiosity. Both are character qualities that are enormously valuable in my view. kind of intellectual humility makes it possible. I mean, without that, how do you ever really learn anything? And curiosity is something that can sustain you when times are pretty difficult and dry. I want to figure out what works here for me. And finally, I think that if you experience all this complexity as baffling and confusing, it's important to notice that being baffled by someone's addiction gives you something in common with that person. They're probably baffled too. And that is a point of connection that has a lot of potential to it. If you pay attention carefully enough to how confused you are, it might lead you to conclude that you really need the help of someone with more power than you've got yourself. And that is, puts you in the first step of recovery yourself. And that can make all the difference, both for you and for somebody else. All right. Talk to me about all this in the forum. Be very interesting to know what you all make of all this. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. Bye.